This is Kathy coming to you with the News Gazette for Wednesday, April the 29th. The headline is Tempest Tossed by Jana Wiersma. A line of storms that prompted more than 50 tornado warnings to be issued as it swept through the area Monday left plenty of damaged trees and structures in its wake. The DeLand-Weldon School District canceled classes on Tuesday and scheduled an e-learning day for today as contractors evaluated roof damage and other impacts. According to Superintendent Michael Tresnack, the roof on the northwest end of the elementary school was damaged when the storm lifted the membrane off the roof. Several skylights are broken in the process, and some HVAC units also sustained damage. A number of our classrooms are not usable at this time, Tresnack said. The rooms received extensive amounts of water damage. All of the ceilings and lighting will have to be replaced. He added that the district plans to reopen as soon as possible, with contractors scheduled to be on site both Tuesday and today. By tomorrow, we should have a better understanding of our next steps, he said Tuesday afternoon. We are currently moving materials from the damaged rooms to other rooms in the building. We'll believe we can move all of the classes to these other rooms. The superintendent added that a number of staff members have volunteered their time to help with classroom setup, which is much appreciated. The DeLand-Weldon family is a very strong family, Tresnack said. Everyone is stepping up to help. The storm also may have been responsible for a blaze in the Philo Fire Protection District on Monday night. According to Chief Shafroth, a barn caught fire in the Tolono Township and at least two horses died. While fire investigators have not released their findings yet, Shafroth said the fire was likely caused by a lightning strike. Firefighters were dispatched to the scene about 8:30 p.m., but the fire had a 20-minute head start on the crews, who couldn't put water on it fast enough or in large enough quantities to stop it, he said. The wind was out of the south, and when we got there, the roof was burned through in the southwest corner, so that basically just made it push the fire the entire length of the building, Shafroth said, comparing the effect to that of a blowtorch. The structure was a total loss. The Philo Fire Protection District shared on social media that several other agencies also responded to the scene. In Mahomet, Lake of the Woods Golf Course closed its facilities Tuesday as downed trees and branches littered the grounds. Head golf pro David Sebestik said the general manager, Chris Edmondson, told him it's one of the worst storms he's seen as far as power and the strength of the winds last night that came through here. There are several trees down on the golf course and on the par 3 course, Sebastik said. We lost power last night as well, which has now been restored, but a ton of branches, a ton of full-on trees came completely down. Sebastik estimated that about 5 to 8 trees came down on the golf course and 1 or 2 on the par 3 course. There were also several trees in wooded areas that were knocked down or half torn out, and that one fell down across the road near hole 11. Power lines also came down due to the storm, and the course saw almost 3 inches of rain. Still, Sebestik said that the trees seemed to have fallen on the rough and fairways rather than the greens, and the pro shop and the clubhouse appeared to be undamaged. One large branch fell on a Champaign County Forest Preserve District vehicle, but he does not believe it caused any major damage. We've got roughly 4 to 6 people out there right now, with chainsaws and cutting trees and branches up, he said at 9:40 a.m. Tuesday. And then hopefully in the afternoon, maybe some people from the natural resources, it's connected to the forest preserve, I hope they're going to come out in the afternoon to help out and clean up some of the debris. He expected to have more news on the course's reopening timeline by that afternoon, and said that golfers could keep an eye on the course's website, gotothelake.com, and social media for updates. And there are several really good pictures taken here. They've got a picture of the top of DeLand Weldon Elementary School roof, and it's all crumbled up. And you can see just pieces of roof and ceiling. There's also a picture of a tree that fell on a house and car in residential Urbana during Monday night storms. More than 2,600 Champaign County residents lost power during the tornado watch. Winds peaked in Gibson City at nearly 60 miles per hour, according to the National Weather Service. And that tree looks like it came up by the... I don't see any roots, but it did come up from underground. It may have been dead, and it's lying on a driveway. And there are pictures of the inside of the school with water all over the floor and papers stuck to the floor and big holes in the ceiling. And then another picture of a tree that's down on the golf course It's a pretty one. So several trees were damaged at Lake of the Woods Golf Course during Monday night's storms, which also led to power outages. And mention again that the golf course is closed right now. Episode 63 of As Heard On. This is aired Monday through Thursday on WDWS at 1400 AM. When it came time to hatch a plan for how to keep the bears from fleeing to Indiana, the Illinois House turned to a one-time Soldier Field usher born in Chicago during the Super Bowl shuffling last year, shuffling year, that was 1985 Democratic State Rep. Cam Buckner, is hopeful that a likely-to-be-revised version of the economic development bill that passed the House in 78-32 last week gets the same support from the Senate, Governor J.B. Pritzker, and, of course, the bears. The bears and the governor have said they're going to make some changes to it, which is part and parcel of the way the legislative process works. But all in all, we've made tremendous strides the last few weeks, Buckner said on Tuesday's edition of News Gazette Radio, powered by GTPS Insurance. A 2007 UVic economics grad and former Illini defensive lineman, Buckner said the state won't join the list of others to write a billion-dollar check to a billion-dollar owners. So while Indiana promised more than $1 billion in public subsidies for a new Bears stadium across the state line in Hammond, Illinois, the deal does not include funding that would go directly toward the building of the franchise's desired $2 billion dome in Arlington Heights. Rather, the bill calls for the Bears to negotiate long-term property tax breaks with local taxing bodies, with any special payments made by the franchise used to lower property tax bills of local residents and Illinoisans statewide. The same arrangement would be available to similar future mega projects, whether the Bears continue to play at Soldier Field or on the grounds of the former Arlington Heights racetrack. Wasn't part of Buckner's charge. My job and the job of people who are in my position is to make sure that whoever the city is, the comma after it says Illinois. On Tuesday's show, Buckner also weighed in on the job fifth-year Illini football coach Brett Bielema has done. Brett has done something in Illinois that people should not underrate. He has made competence feel normal. Those who have been around a while know that's a big deal. This program is not living off one cute season anymore. They just had back-to-back 9-win seasons for the first time in history. Back-to-back ranked seasons for the first time since the late 80s. That's not a blip. That's architecture. And that was written by Jeff DeLazio. And on tap today, the baseball broadcaster Bob Costas, Hounds Court owner Jim Enderly, and Craig Allen Smith, star of the touring musical Mrs. Doubtfire, which stops Saturday at the State Farm Center. Sandy's trial, day two. Woman testifies the officer's drink sedated her, and that's in quotes. She claims she passed out and woke to being violated by Luke Taylor. A woman who alleged a University of Illinois police officer sexually assaulted her 8 years ago testified Tuesday, the second day of the former officer's trial. She admitted that some details of the alleged September 19, 2018 were foggy in her memory after so much time passed, but she was very sure about what happened that night. The alleged victim said she met Gerald Jerry Sandage, 54, of Leroy, a day prior at a county music concert in Springfield. The concert was starting a bit late, and Sandage and another man approached her and struck up a conversation. Over the course of no more than 10 or 15 minutes, the three spoke casually, she said, and both men identified themselves as police officers. Also during that conversation, the woman and Sandage realized they lived in the same Savoy apartment complex, where he also worked as a security guard. They exchanged contact information, and then she said she stepped away to enjoy the concert. She was there alone, having just moved into the area for a temporary 6-week job that started that week. She used the stipend from that job to sublet an apartment in the Savoy complex. The woman described Sandage as a balding, overweight older man who was not attractive, but said he and the other man he was with reminded her of her dad. The next day, the woman said Sandage contacted her and asked if she would like to go with him to listen to a local artist performing in Philo. Since it was the day before her birthday, she agreed, she said. The pair had dinner together and talked, and she had a beer. She described the conversation as casual and said she viewed him as sort of a local tour guide and safe person to be around during her stay. Next, the woman said they went to a bar for the concert itself, and she had about 5 more beers and 1 shot over the course of the evening. The defendant then drove the pair of them back to the apartment complex and asked if she wanted to go inside and look at the guitar they had talked about. The woman said she was buzzed and that her blood alcohol content was probably high enough that she was glad she wasn't driving, but that she wasn't slurring her words, stumbling, or feeling particularly intoxicated. As the pair got into the apartment, one of her friends called to wish her happy birthday, as it was nearly midnight. The woman said Sandage offered her a drink and she accepted, and that he gave her what tasted like a whiskey and cola while she was still on the phone call. She said she couldn't recall how much of the beverage she drank, but said that she started to feel very heavy and tired after a while. Sandage allegedly suggested she go lie down in his bed rather than making the walk over to her apartment, and she said she did so because she felt so unwell and was confused with what was happening. She alleged that Sandage put something in the drink and said she felt sedated. The woman said she fell asleep there and that she woke up later to find Sandage touching her with his genitals. She described wanting to scream and tell him to stop, but she couldn't remember if she actually managed to or not. After passing out or falling asleep again, she alleged she woke up a second time to Sandage performing non-consensual intercourse with her. She said she woke up again in the morning and he could hear a shower running, so she gathered her things and went home and showered. It was Friday, so she still had work, and it was her birthday. Her new co-workers had a dinner planned for her that night. She said she went to work feeling like she just needed to get through the day and could handle everything the next day. James Martinkus, Sandage's attorney, questioned her about social media posts she'd made about having fun at the party. The woman said she wasn't having very much fun at all, but didn't want other people to know that. She also messaged Sandage on Snapchat that day, accusing him of raping her, and he said he was sorry she saw it that way and that they had both had too much to drink. She ended up reporting the alleged assault on Saturday and was questioned by police through that evening and the next day. The trial continues and is expected to reach a conclusion today. Moving to some more local news. On Wednesdays and continuing through harvest season, the News Gazette's Rob LaCates will spotlight a farm family of the week. Meet the Seavers family of Potomac. For Brian Seavers, the chairman of the Illinois Soybean Association and an American soybean director, working on the farm alongside his sons is the greatest gift he's been given. The question is, how long has your family been farming? I have been farming since 1988. My grandpa started in the 1920s, and then my dad took over for him in 1976. My dad retired in 2014, and then I took over all the operations. I farmed with him when I graduated from college in 1988. I worked in an ag retail service from 1999 to 2007, when I came back to farm full-time again. Both of my boys now farm with me. They came back to the farm with me in 2014. Question, where is your farm operation? We are in Vermilion County in Potomac. How and why did your family come to this area, and where did they come from? My grandpa was in La Place farming for a landlord. The landlord bought a farm around Collison and asked him to move up here in the late 1940s. Question, what does your farming operation consist of? Is it strictly a grain operation, livestock, or other? Answer, we raise non-GMO soybeans and corn with about a 50-50 rotation. Michael and Jenna have a small herd of Angus beef cows. Question, how many people in the family does the operation support? The farm supports three families, me, my two sons, and their families. We have three full-time men on staff and then seasonal part-time help. Question, how many generations of farmers are there? Answer, my dad, me, my sons, and my grandkids, so four generations on the farm right now. My mom and dad are Dudley and Joy. My wife is Cindy. Michael and Nicholas are my sons and are married to Jenna and Mackenzie, respectively. My grandchildren are Tripp, Eastland, and Ada. Do you have any members of the family in the operation also working other jobs? Cindy works at Potomac Grade School. So it says, this morning on WHMS, 97.5 FM, at 8:20, Mike in the Morning visits with Brian Seavers. Jenna works for Cargill as a market analyst, and Mackenzie works at a hospice RN and case manager at Transitions in Danville. How and why did you come to be the director of the American Soybean Association and the chairman of the Illinois branch? I started at the Illinois Soybean Association in July 2020. I was asked to run for the board, and I didn't know much about the ISA at that time, but I knew they were taking money out of my soybean checks. The more I learned about the checkoff program, the more I wanted to be involved in the decisions of how the checkoff dollars are being used to help farmers in Illinois. As a farmer, I have learned a lot about how the checkoff is used for finding new markets and new uses, advocating with the state and federal legislatures and agencies of the government, for instance, the USDA. I've also learned more about soybean production, like how to raise more beans efficiently, research projects to help fight diseases and different practices. I have been the soybean production chair and treasurer for 2 years each. Question, what does the average day look like with your job? What are the responsibilities that people may not assume come with the role? The day starts off with looking at and answering emails before the boys get here to start the day at the farm. Spending time in the office was never my favorite, but it seems with today's world, staying on top of all the events going on is a constant job. I surround myself with good people to help with all things. For markets, that Jenna does most of the day-to-day things. The boys do, so I can concentrate on my roles with the soybean organizations. Without them, it wouldn't be possible. It has taught the boys lots in running the farming operations when I'm gone to meetings and trade missions overseas, trying to sell more soybeans to potential new customers. Farming is an ever-changing landscape and always something to tend to or work to be done on equipment. What are some of your major goals with your leadership positions? To help move the pile. At ESA, we have a great staff that does the work for our farmers in Illinois, directed by our 24 board members from all over the state. Some of the things we are working on are the Soy Innovation Center, where we are coming up with new uses for soybeans, from soy-based grease to a lot of new ideas that the university is working on for us. Basically, anything that is made of petroleum-based products can be made with soybeans, which is a sustainable product. The Government Relations Group works in Springfield with lawmakers to help get bills passed that help farmers from pesticides to biofuel soybean production. It helps with research on new ways to fight disease and helps us raise more bushels, which then the trade missions help with the new buyers for the soybeans. In the end, I want to see us help keep the prices up with all the arms of ISA so the family farms in Illinois can be profitable and can be passed down the road to the next generation to be successful. The use of the internet to be able to know what's going on in the world has helped us to grow our farm and be profitable, and the ability to raise more bushels and be able to sell them. The average bushels per acre grows fast with new hybrids and disease packages, and I can't forget the technology in today's equipment from autopath to autosteer. Agriculture is changing fast. Your farm equipment? Green, red, or other? We have all the colors, mostly John Deere tractors, but we have red ones too. We use class combines to harvest our crops. What makes farming such a good vocation? It is the stewardship of the ground, taking care of it for the next generation, being your own boss and making decisions that will ultimately affect your bottom line. Mother Nature is always in charge, so you plant the crops and count on the weather to help. Being outside and working next to the family every day is the best part. What soil conservation practices do you employ on your farm? We still strip our corn ground in the fall and minimum till our soybean ground with a light pass in the fall. We are trying cover crops, but have a lot to learn. If you could change one thing about farming, what would it be? The weather, ha ha. We haven't been able to control that and never will, so we learn to adapt to it. What's the best time of the year to be on the farm? Harvest. It's when you get a paycheck and you get to see the fruits of your labor that you worked for all year. And the pictures that accompany this article are some of his grandchildren, Tripp and Ada, and then a picture of Brian and Tripp in a combine at the family farm. So they're sitting up in the tractor in the cab. And there is a picture of the whole family with their grandchildren. And from Illinois State University, striking staff frustrated over lack of negotiations. The workers seek higher pay and alleged replacements have been hired. By Ben Zalinski. Non-teaching staff at the Illinois State University have been on strike for 4 weeks and are growing frustrated at the lack of negotiations between the union and administrators. The maintenance, buildings, and ground service workers, who are represented by AFSCME Council 31, have been on strike since April 8th, demanding higher pay. As a result, the students of the campus in Normal have dealt with dirty bathrooms, garbage piling up, and limited dining options. A group of striking workers traveled Tuesday to the Capitol in Springfield to call attention to their strike, which has become an issue in the governor's race. Without us, I know they're not getting the quality of cleaning they deserve, building service worker Sue Perry told reporters at a news conference in Springfield. Little progress has been made in negotiations since January, according to Renee Nessler, AFSCME staff representative. That's when the university put forward its latest offer, which it also says is its final offer. ISU has offered staff members a plan that would grant a 3.5% raise when the new contract is ratified, bringing hourly wages to $21.34 on average for dining hall employees and $22.78 for building services employees, the two largest groups of workers in the union. Workers would be slated for a 3% annual raise every July through 2029. But the union says the lack of retroactive pay since workers did not receive a raise last July is a major problem. They are seeking a 3.5% wage increase retroactive to the beginning of the fiscal year last summer, along with certainty that the staff members will be a part of the campus wage program. The program would allow staff members to receive a greater wage increase when their management receives an increase above the yearly standard. Union leaders said negotiations over the last 4 months have been unproductive and no future bargaining sessions are scheduled. "We know the community values us because every day brings an outpouring of support," said Union President Chuck Carver, a building service worker. "The ones who don't value up are high up in the administration. They are ignoring our well-being of the students and damaging ISU's reputation." The strike also escalated into a lawsuit against the university. The union alleges the university has hired new, non-unionized workers to replace the striking workers while they're off the job. "We are fighting for fair pay and dignity, and while they're saying they can't afford it, they're paying these scab companies more than what we make," Carver said, claiming the contracted vendors are making $38 to $197 an hour, compared to ISU's $16 floor for many workers. ISU asked the court to dismiss the case. Native American Summit, Culture Policy Combined, an event promoting issues connecting people to lawmakers, by Nicole Hytrek and UIS Public Affairs reporter. Drums and bells echoed as people dressed in regalia sang and danced traditional dances at the 4th Annual Native American Summit at the Illinois Capitol. The theme for the gathering was community, awareness, and connection. People from several Native American tribes gathered in the Capitol Rotunda on Tuesday to raise awareness and share information about important issues for Native communities. "We have so many roots, so many connections, not only to Illinois, but to our own tribal nations, that we are here making our voice heard. And you all are making our voice heard," said Andrew Johnson, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and director of advocacy for the Chicago American Indian Community Collaborative. CAICC isn't producing specific legislation this session, so the summit was focused on meeting with lawmakers and reminding them that we're still here and will always be here, said Marnie Smiley, a member of the Oto Missouri tribe, the facilitator for CAICC. Priority issues for CAICC include allowing tribal languages to satisfy education requirements for learning a foreign language, establishing a Native American caucus in both chambers of the General Assembly to specifically discuss policies regarding Native Americans, and working with the state to research affordable housing and homelessness. There are 9 total issues listed on CAICC's website. Jasmine Gurnow, a member of the Oneida and Menominee tribe and president of CAICC, said that Native issues aren't different for those any different from those of other minority groups, particularly when it comes to disparities in accessing health care, affordable housing, education, and dealing with the criminal justice system. "Native issues are different," Gurnow said, "because tribal nations are sovereign, but Native Americans are still considered U.S. citizens. A long history of broken treaties, illegal land grabs, and forced assimilation has led to the variety of cultural considerations the CAICC would like the General Assembly to consider." And there's a picture here of the dancers in their traditional regalia perform at the 4th Annual Native American Summit at the Illinois Capitol on Tuesday. Some beautiful embroidery, very colorful. Election 2027. Danville Alderwoman joins the race for mayor, by Jennifer Bailey. Local business owner and Ward 4 Alderwoman Tricia Teague will join what's becoming a crowded field of candidates for Danville mayor in 2027. During a campaign kickoff event at 6 p.m. Monday, Teague will become the third candidate to announce plans to run for the job currently held by Ricky Williams, Jr., joining the Reverend Frank McCullough, pastor of Mount Olive Baptist Church and co-founder of Three Kings of Peace, and former Danville police officer Dennis Witzman. Teague calls herself a change agent and invited the public to join in the movement. On her campaign website, change4danville.com, she has posted a 12-point plan for the city, which includes economic development, business retention and attraction, housing, remote worker recruitment, and small business development and support. Teague said she's running because she wants to reverse Danville's decline. It's going to take an out-of-the-box thinking and bold actions to grow our city, she said. As an entrepreneur, I know about thinking outside the box. Former Alderwoman Brenda Brown is scheduled to endorse Teague, who will have more to say Monday at her Source Space Business Center at 2 East Main Street, Suite 36 in the town's Central Riverfront Plaza. The event is open to the public and refreshments will be served. In this article by Jim Day, appeals court concludes evidence against Madigan proved bribery. Madigan, that's how the late boxing sportscaster Howard Cosell would have described the effect of the devastating punch thrown Monday by a federal appeals court at longtime Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. An opinion quickly released after April 9th oral arguments, a unanimous three-judge panel had no trouble concluding that Madigan accepted payoffs for years for Commonwealth Edison in exchange for supporting utility-backed legislation. From 2011 to 2019, ComEd lined the pockets of Madigan's close political allies. These payments were in exchange for Madigan's support, advancing ComEd's legislative agenda, wrote Justice Michael Scudder. The Madigan decision comes shortly after a separate panel overturned the convictions of two of Madigan's alleged co-conspirators, former utility CEO Ann Pramaggiore and company lobbyist and Madigan friend Michael McLean. The Pramaggiore-McLean panel ruled in their favor because it found jurors in their cases might have been confused about the meaning of the federal bribery statute. Although released from prison, both still face prosecution. But the Madigan panel, Scudder and Justices Frank Easterbrook and Nancy Maldonado, had no trouble reaching the conclusion that ComEd won Madigan's legislative favor by providing lucrative no-show jobs and legal work to Madigan associates. Scudder wrote that Madigan spent nearly a decade leveraging his power in exchange for over $3 million of financial benefits for his close political allies. The linkage was clear and far from fleeting, he wrote in a 29-page opinion. He repeatedly facilitated changes to state law impacting countless energy consumers in northern Illinois, all because ComEd funneled money to the right people. Madigan insists this was an all run-of-the-mill politics, but a jury of 12 Illinois residents saw the evidence differently. So do we. The opinion likely closes the door on Madigan's serious efforts to overturn his conviction on multiple corruption charges. He could ask the panel to reconsider or seek a bank review by all of the judges on the Seventh Circuit. Madigan also could ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case, the longest of long shots since the High Court hears only a small percentage of the cases submitted to it. He's already asked President Donald Trump for a pardon or a sentence commutation. Once considered among Illinois' most powerful and most talented and ruthless politicians, Madigan is being held at federal prison in West Virginia. Having turned 84 on April 18th, he's serving a 7.5-year sentence. Ironically, Madigan is the only one of the six original ComEd bribery conspiracy defendants currently in prison. Pramaggiore and McLean recently released, while two others, lobbyists John Hooker and Jay Doherty, did not appeal and served relatively short sentences. Another Madigan insider, former Chief of Staff Tim Mapes, is also set to be released from custody this summer. Madigan served as Speaker for all but 2 years between 1983 and 2021, using his vast influence to ensure that nothing passed in law without his support or acquiescence. Ruling with an iron fist, he destroyed Democrats who mistakenly crossed him while lavishing campaign funds and favors on those who did his bidding. Resistance to Madigan's management style was futile. Final publicity over the ongoing ComEd bribery conspiracy weakened him to the point that House Democrats summoned the courage to reject his efforts to be re-elected as Speaker. But federal resources, including tape-recorded conversations, turncoat Madigan operatives, and years of investigative work, turned the latter Madigan prophecy into a fatal conceit. And that was written by Jim Day. And that's all for part one. I'll be right back with part two of the News Gazette.